It's the Christmas Without Hitchens edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, the killer cookie dough, Habs homeopathy, Christmas hormones, and the reality of Christmas. Let's begin episode 146.
Where did that come on?
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello, listeners.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, your skeptic radio podcast in Vancouver, 101.9 FM. This is the sans-free edition of Radio Free Thinker. Ethan is not here with us today. So you have Dawn, your political science philosopher.
And Jenny, your biochemist, none of which know how to turn on the right microphone for our introduction.
Yeah, so if you hear some weirdness today, it's a small technical glitch because of the super high-tech new equipment CITR has hoped to buy in the future. And like neutrinos that can travel into the future, our episode glitches are also coming from the future.
On here, I just thought it was a Christmas surprise.
Yes. Well, so this week, Jenna, horrible news and good news, depending on who and how and where you are. The good news,
go on.
If you're geopolitical, is the dictator leader, the Im Sol-won-hwi leader of North Korea, has passed on in a surprise heart attack. No one expected that. North Korea is renowned for doing things that are unexpected, and the untimely death of its leader has taken the West by surprise.
And apparently, you know, unpredictable behavior in the context of a country goes right down to the cardiac health of its leader.
I was surprised to find out that apparently he died like on Friday, and Western spies, quote-unquote, didn't know about it until the national broadcast of the news on Sunday, like 48 hours earlier, which is kind of weird. But now, of course, on a sadder note, or sad note, again, depending on how you think, Christopher Hitchens passed on this week after his fight with esophageal cancer.
So a little less unexpected than sudden heart attacks.
Exactly. Actually, he's been praised quite a bit because, of course, being one of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse for atheists, member of the new atheist movement. He's been quite renowned as an outspoken critic of religion, among other things. And right up to the end, he said, listen, I've got one life to live. I'm going to live it as well as I can. And I'm going to be happy with that life. I don't need any sort of mystic woo to think that after I die, I will go to someplace else.
Right.
Although, of course, from what I understand, it took mere seconds for the Christian right type people to sit there and say, I bet you he's got a big surprise now, which of course seems to be really kind of tacky in some ways.
I mean,
not tacky for atheists. If we say that, it's like, well, we're heathen, we're immoral. But I mean, Christians are supposed to be moral, ethical, caring people.
I thought that most people, you know, it was sort of passé to insult people directly after their death and make insinuations about where they may or may not be going or not going. You know, seems like there's some sort of statute of limitations on the amount of time that it's supposed to take.
True. You know, and actually, it's bizarre. Chris Richards is one of those unique characters in the skeptic movement. Jenna, you're not big in the skeptic community, so I'm not sure how much you know about Christopher Hitchens.
Not nearly as literate as you, Don.
Well, you know, he's one of those unique figures. He grew up, he came from a very socialist, Marxist background. He has quite often been a fierce opponent of religion, although he's also one of these people that he had a what he calls a life-turning moment in Bosnia, where he saw what he
thought.
An epiphany, where he kind of went from a let's be peaceful and sort of somewhat pacifist to a degree, to we need to intervene. 9/11 had a very strong impact on him as well, and he's most criticized now from the skeptic point of being very much in favor of the Iraq War. But to give him credit, he had enough fortitude to have himself waterboarded. So, and he says, "Listen, I don't know what anyone else says. Waterboarding is torture." And so, other than that, he's been a mixed bag. good in some areas, bad in other areas.
But influential nonetheless.
Very influential. And definitely, no one could say that he was not a character. People who loved or hated his political points of view loved the fact that he was the sort of Renaissance rogue of our times. Right? You know, a bastard in debates. Very colorful. The person you... Everyone who sits there and talks about him sort of says, you know, he'd sit there and he'd have a big stogie in one hand, a glass of high-class scotch in the other, I think scotch, and he would regale you with tales past and present and literary, and it's a shame that he's gone, and we're sad. But we are not sad.
Well, we're sad about other things, too.
Well, especially considering one of the greatest things in the world, when you come home and you're sad and you need that pick-me-up, that little bit of comfort food.
You know, the one thing that can get you through that night, they're just it being ripped away from us. And I consider it, you know, one of the rights of human dignity, one of the you know, it's immutable. It's something that we should all be allowed, the eating of cookie dough. But apparently,
cookie dough.
I know. Mm, this right is being squashed.
What?
That's right.
Well, this has got to be some form of right-wing conspiracy to increase government to delve into our homes and steal the last vestiges of wholesomeness and goodness in this country.
And right around the time when there's the most cookies being made and therefore the most dough available. No, apparently the eating of cookie dough is going the way of the dodo birds, or at least should, according to most health experts.
So how exactly is this killer cookie dough assassinating its unsuspecting victims?
Well, the whole problem, you know, I'm not sure if you're aware of the cookie making process, but first you put a whole bunch of raw ingredients together in a bowl and you mush them up.
You mean before you have cooked food, you have raw food?
Correct. Wow. So the cooking of food, one of the reasons we do it, other than to make certain components more digestible, is actually to kill bacteria, as well as denature certain bacterial toxins that can cause disease in human beings.
And by denature, you mean detoxify?
No, the term is actually denature. So lots of toxins are made by... proteins, they're made up of proteins, and denaturing just means making the protein lose its shape and therefore its function. And heat does that.
Making it not toxic.
It does make it not toxic, but to detoxify a toxin seems a little bit redundant.
Speaking of redundancy, what about cookie dough ice cream? Should I be worried about that?
Yes. They want you to stop making it.
So what exactly are they saying is happening, and what is the specific culprit in mind? Is it the sugar?
Well, no. Okay, as much as, you know, sugar is delicious, and cooking doesn't do a lot to sugar other than, you know, change its state maybe, but it doesn't change its chemical nature. So what we're doing, again, when we're cooking food is mostly getting rid of these pathogens, so things that can make you sick. Heat can kill bacteria. It can also denature the proteins, as we were talking about. And so before you have the food cooked, as in dough form when we're talking about cookies, these things are alive and well and can make you sick. So we're worried about having raw ingredients such as raw eggs, which have historically been a big problem, but a bit of a surprise, raw flour.
From what I understand, a lot of the cases in the United States involve actually E. coli and a particular toxin that an E. coli can produce. And granted, in the articles that I read, and there have been innumerable out there, the CBC's had it, New York Times had it, a few other ones have had it. In commercial cookie dough, you go, okay, we're kind of used to the fact that in any industrial setting, some poor guy goes to the bathroom or some such thing, doesn't wash his hands, comes to the factory floor, gives everyone in the entire universe E. coli thanks to his own particular production thereof. But in my reading, actually, apparently they were mentioning that flour is actually one of the higher sources of potential sources, I guess is the right word to put, of contamination for homemade cookie dough. Because I'm going to homemade cookie dough. I mean, salmonella, eggs themselves, we were talking about before the show.
Yep.
I mean, eggs are hermetically sealed.
Pretty much.
And the odds of getting salmonella from eggs itself is pretty much, at least in the modern context, rather hard to get if it's a whole egg you're using.
Again, right.
Eggs in the context of an industrial factory, very, very different sort of
scenario.
Well,
and if you're worried about eggs as well, it's kind of a good idea to rinse the outside of them before cracking them open, if you're worried about it.
But apparently flour, because flour is at no point processed to the point where it gets rid of any of its toxins that might be in there.
Mm-hmm.
And something like, I think it was 14 to 17%, at least in the New York Times article I was reading, percent of flour has some form of E. coli or bacterial infection, including salmonella, which I must admit, I always thought salmonella was an egg thing exclusively, but I guess it can bacteria be is...
Yeah, they're sort of environmental organisms, E. coli, salmonella, they can live in different environments. What was surprising to me about the flour thing is flour is so dry. And most of the time, you know, for really proliferative bacterial growth, you need a little bit more moisture, but I guess, you know, sometimes, depending on the organism, just a few bugs is enough to make you sick.
Life will find a way.
So we're just going to take a break here on Radio Free Thinker before we come back and talk a little bit about some homeopathy popping up where you might or might not expect it in the world of professional sport.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey / Movie Night in Canada. You're listening to CITR 101.9.
This is Colin from GBH, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and that's Canada, boys.
Hello, listeners. Ethan, your free-thinking historian here in our virtual studio today. Unfortunately, I couldn't be live with Dawn and Jenna, but I trust they're holding the fort down in the meantime. Today, I wanted to talk to you about hockey. In fact, the goaltender for the Montreal Canadiens. And no, we haven't become a sports talk show. This is relevant to skeptics in Canada. Carey Price, the BC-born goalie who currently plays for the Montreal Canadiens, is a spokesperson for the homeopathic product Oscillium, produced by the Boron Company in Quebec. What is Oscillium, you might ask? Some sort of herbal remedy or natural product? Nope. It's homeopathy. And that means it's a form of alternative medicine wherein the ingredients are diluted repeatedly in water over and over again, transferring via supernatural means its essence into the memory of water. Oscillium, in reality, is duck liver, as explained by Dr. Joe Schwartz on his blog and podcast, The Right Chemistry. Quote, take the carcass of a duck and place 35 grams of its liver and 15 grams of its heart in 1 liter bottle filled with a solution of pancreatic juice and glucose. Wait 40 days until the liver and heart have disintegrated, then dilute the solution to 100 liters. Then take 1 liter of the solution and dilute it again to 100 liters. Repeat the dilution process another 199 times, shaking the solution with a specific fashion each time. Then take a small pellet of milk sugar and moisten it with the resulting solution. That's a good summary by Dr. Schwartz. As with all homeopathic products, the end result is you have a sugar pill that has been exposed to a drop of water that supposedly contains an active ingredient, but instead has been diluted so much, in fact, diluted to 200 C, a ratio of one part duck to 100 to the 200th power parts water. That's 100 followed by 200 zeros. You would need to consume an amount of the remedy, roughly 10 to the 300th 21st power, that's 10 followed by 321 zeros, to get one molecule of the active ingredient. For reference, the number of atoms in the observable universe is 100 to the power of 40. Boron, the company that produces Oscillium, recently partnered with the Montreal Canadiens to promote their products. One might ask what the harm could be with such an arrangement. Surely the Montreal Canadiens are not a medical organization, and their endorsement of boron is not the same as a medical establishment. But if we consider the implications of what message this sends to the public, we see some troubling ideas. As a professional sports team, the Montreal Canadiens do have considerable sway on what is considered healthy, or at the very least, what helps athletic performance. Consider how coaches for children will base their coaching methods on what is taught at the professional level. Or consider how athletic training equipment used by a professional sports team is likely to be used by local gyms and college teams. Boron has recently been in the skeptical news cycle. In California, the company is being sued for fraud and unfair competition over their homeopathic remedy Cold Calm, which also contains no active ingredient. Boron was also threatening to sue an Italian blogger, claiming his posts about Oscillium are deflammatory. However, their attempts to intimidate the blogger backfired. It simply drew more attention to what he wrote and resulted in more criticism against Boron for selling a product that contained no active ingredient. The situation eventually came to the attention of the British Medical Journal, at which point Boron backed down and apologized. Listeners may recall that I was on CBC's consumer protection show, CBC Marketplace, where a group of Vancouver skeptics overdosed on homeopathy. The producers of Marketplace talked with Baran, but received some pretty unsatisfactory answers. They suggested the idea that not having an active ingredient was just the point of view of science and wasn't very important. The producers of Marketplace also asked us what we thought about the Montreal Canadiens partnering with Baran. Although that part didn't make it into the final cut of the episode, we all agreed that as Canuck fans, if the Montreal Canadiens want to be silly, that's their business. However, they should be honest with the fans at the very least. During our second homeopathic overdose in Vancouver, which we did during the International 1023 event, I consumed a case of Oscillium in under 10 minutes. Had I done this with medicine that contained an active ingredient, I may not be here today. I'm sure that Carey Price is a fantastic goaltender. Well, reasonably fantastic. I am a Canucks fan after all. But he's not a doctor. He shouldn't be endorsing a medical product, especially something that's as dubious as homeopathy. Like many other celebrities that attach their name to what might seem like a trendy medical product, Carey Price is inadvertently helping to promote homeopathy and non-science-based medicine. As somebody who has considerable sway in the Montreal community, this is very unfortunate. He could be potentially endangering lives. Likewise, the Montreal Canadiens, as an influential member of their community, should be responsible and endorse only science-based medicine. In fact, I encourage all hockey fans and all skeptics out there, send messages to the Montreal Canadiens. Send messages to Carey Price. Inform them that homeopathy is not science-based medicine, it's not going to cure the flu or prevent the flu, and it certainly isn't a replacement for science-based medicine. And that concludes this bit of skeptical news with Ethan, your free-thinking historian. Let's turn things back to Don and Jenna on Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The music says it all, but we'd like to say it again. Thank you from all of us at CITR for your generous support during our 2011 fund drive. We just couldn't do it without you.
You made a million dreams come true, and so I'm saying thank a million to you.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
All right, everybody. So we've been talking, you know, a little bit about homeopathy, a little bit about Christmas. So when you think of Christmas, Don, do you follow your nose?
I think of cooking, the smells, the odors, the taste, the flavors of Christmas. I think of all sorts of wonderful things, and I desperately try not to think about the cold outside.
Well, that's probably a good approach. So there's some scientists recently that decided to investigate the smells of Christmas from a little bit of a more scientific standpoint. So I was reading a paper in the journal Appetite that investigated whether or not certain smells were sort of more familiar and more pleasant at different times of the year.
Is this a journal or is this a cooking magazine? Because there's Bon Appetit.
No, this is a real one, Appetite, which I assume actually, I haven't read a lot of articles from this particular journal, but I mean, they're considering the sort of health bend to a lot of the, and lifestyle bend to a lot of the research happening right now. I suspect it's actually a journal that is quite pertinent to a lot of policy and that kind of thing. So in any case, what these scientists did is they first gave people a list of 12 different scents, and they gave them without actually smelling the scent and asked them to identify whether or not some of these scents might be more associated with summertime, more associated with Christmas time, or no specific season. And so they asked 100 people these questions. Then they asked 41 people during the summer season, whether these same 12 smells, without giving them their names, just having them smell the smell, asking them to rate them based on familiarity and based on pleasantness.
How come you smell the smell, but you don't look the look?
Well, actually, surprisingly enough, the researchers were looking the look, but I'll get into that. So they asked 41 people to smell these smells and rate them during the summertime, and 51 people to do the same thing during the Christmas season. So not an enormous sample size.
Okay.
And what they did also is they tried to control the environment. So all of these trials happened inside the same area of a science museum in Germany. That was sort of, you know, in environmentally controlled conditions. However, in what I can only assume is an attempt to sort of enhance the seasonality of what was going on as opposed to what might be happening outside in their daily lives, the researchers that were testing people during the summer were dressed in T-shirts and, oh, gasp, even short pants.
What? In Germany?
And the, aren't those in a science museum, no less.
Well, that's Lederhosen, isn't it?
And the people that were testing people during Christmas actually wore a Santa hat and were at a booth that was decorated in festive attire.
Okay.
So we're having people trying to make these associations. And what they found is that almost everyone associated cinnamon with the Christmas season. And this was the strongest association that everyone made when they were just trying to identify which smells they thought intellectually would be associated with one season or another. And indeed, cinnamon did smell more familiar and more pleasant during the Christmas season than it did during the summer season.
Hmm.
So all that seems to make some sort of sense, yes?
Well, yeah, and you can kind of see how they're, you know, eggnog and that you have during the summer season, the winter season.
I was going to say, you find eggnog during the summer.
But during the summer, you tend to have different flavors, mint maybe, or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the authors concluded from these that the olfactory responses, that is your smell, change with the season, and that this is demonstrated by this association with Christmas and cinnamon. However, when you read further into the study, you see that rose was actually also more familiar and more pleasant during the Christmas season.
That doesn't make any sense. Wouldn't it be poinsettias or something?
Well, apparently, if I may quote from the study, different from all the other odors, rose odor was more related
the smell of roses.
Was more related to summertime through ratings of familiarity and pleasantness were higher during the Christmas season. So the authors state that a possible explanation for this controversy may be that in many cases, rose odor, this is apparently an unexpected tongue twister, is found in perfumes or fragrances. So considering that perfume sales usually increase during Christmas, the higher familiarity and hedonic rating of the rose odor during Christmas season could be explained by the more frequent contact with perfume or fragrance via perfume purchasing or receiving during the Christmas season.
That particularly sounds hard for you to say. The
it really
purchasing
is.
Purchasing preferences of particular people.
Well, and tongue-twisting challenges aside, I mean, I find it really interesting that, you know, they take the almost exact same result, one for cinnamon, one for rose. Yeah. One's expected, one's not expected. And they're like, well, we can make this expected.
Sounds like post hoc sort of shoehorning in.
Oh, yeah. And a similar thing was found for coffee, which was found to be more familiar and more pleasant during the summertime, which you wouldn't necessarily expect. And it said that we consider that many subjects associated coffee odor with cold coffee or iced coffee, and the results of coffee seem to therefore be more understandable.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, this, I mean, first of all, the fact that they dressed up differently between the summer and the winter makes me kind of question the whole thing overall. Right, I mean...
You think they just like to play dress-up?
Well, no. I mean, they're adding confounding issues there, right? So, I mean, is it the fact that the smell is triggering Christmassy image, feelings?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it the fact that, hey, I see people dressed up in candy canes and looking very festive?
Right.
Is that the overriding issue?
Right.
And then, as you're pointing out, I mean, things that are associated with Christmas are things like the scent of pine from Christmas trees.
Yes.
You know, scented candles.
Well, they identified the strongest ones to be cinnamon, cloves, and orange. which are very popular for German mulled wine and that kind of
thing. Well, and there goes, that's the other issue I'm going, is, I mean, are these sort of Christmassy things, or are these German things, right?
Well, regardless, I mean, whatever confounding factors and that kind of thing you have, the fact is that they're interpreting the same results in different ways to fit the hypothesis, which is never a good way to advance science. So there's another study I was looking at that was looking at things that might really make you feel Christmassy. And what might those be? Why, hormones, of course. What could be more Christmassy than hormones? So this is a paper that I found in the Journal of Neuroendocrinology, labeled Christmas, an event driven by our hormones?
That sounds bizarre.
Yeah, well, let me give you a brief idea of the abstract here. So this is, no other event in the Christian calendar has such a deep impact on our behavior as the annual event called Christmas. Christmas is not just Christmas Day. Indeed, it is a long developmental rhythm with a period of almost exactly 365 days. So here I describe the neuronal and hormonal exchanges and their effects on our behavior during the preparation and execution for the event.
Okay.
So it looks like we're going to do a serious study of hormones controlling Christmas. So basically, what this study was looking at is whether or not there actually is a periodicity that is actually having to do with endogenous mechanisms in our body, as opposed to just the external fact that a calendar happens to have Christmas on one day.
Right. Is Christmas Christmas because the calendar tells you so? Or is it part of sort of your circadian type rhythm? Is it part of the biological urge to get all Christmassy at this time of year? And the biology more drives the date than the date drives the biology.
Exactly. And you might think, like, this might be sort of a ridiculous thing to look at. You know, doesn't seem all that likely. However, the authors make an argument in the introduction that attempts to phase shift Christmas from its normal time frame, example, after a long period of illness, have been ineffective. They don't really cite a reference for that. And that a lack of Christmas feelings has also been described on occasions when the event is celebrated outside its normal spatial milieu. Example, as an astronaut in space or a shipwrecked person on a remote, culturally deprived island.
Now, not to poke holes in this, what I am sure is a well-studied phenomenon, but what about Greek Orthodox or Orthodox religion, which celebrate Christmas in January 16th or thereabouts?
Well, they actually suggest that this working hypothesis that it is a complex neuroendocrine substrate of the circle annual Christmas rhythm as opposed to the circadian rhythm, whose zenith is preceded by intense anticipatory locomotor activity, which is characterized by hedonic hyperphagia and which is succeeded by a phase of torpor. And apparently this is all untrainable by food and drink.
Well, you know, you have used so many $100 words in that sentence that I'm just, I sit back and go, wow, I didn't understand half of that. It must be true.
Well, I think what we're looking at here, if we may take apart this sentence, that we're looking at a process controlled by hormones that is a made-up word for Christmas rhythm, and the climax of this event has you being very busy, and then eating a lot very excitedly, and then being very tired.
No, but that's not what they said. They said the zenith of our rhythm and locomotion, and you're not telling me that these fancy words have actually simplistic meaning.
Well,
I'm beginning to doubt.
I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. So these are one of these delightful Christmas articles that is, in fact, using scientific jargon and language to be able to disguise completely trivial thoughts or findings in sort of a cloak of scientificness. So this article suggests that Christmas has four phases, which is the organizational phase, the active phase of hormone release and positive feedback, a behavioral climax followed by negative feedback. So you can sort of imagine what these phases might be. The organizational phase, which the author suggests has actually been moved up over the decades, and they are trying to figure out the hormonal implications of this, whereas it used to begin at the beginning of December and now seems to begin at the beginning of October. We have the active phase of hormone release, where you're seeing all the lights and this is triggering a feedback mechanism that's then getting you more Christmassy, that spreads the Christmas spirit and everybody catches it. followed by a behavioral climax where you just stuff your face and have major blowouts with family, and a negative feedback phase, which is described that at the zenith of the circannual rhythm, various adverse side effects emerge that may be attributed to excess of intracerebral levels of prestagon, which functionally antagonize satiety signaling. So basically that you are unable to tell when you are full.
Well, I was going to say, so the first phase sounds like advertising Christmas is coming. The second phase is putting up all
and
the decorations.
Making your lists.
Right.
Checking them twice.
Doing all the decorations, buying your gifts. The third phase, Christmas, opening up your gifts, overeating and all that. And the fourth phase is the hangover and getting the Visa bill in the mail.
It's the Boxing Day blues.
Yeah.
So we have feeding and drinking behaviors persist, disconnected from all cognitive restraint or sensory modulation. You have an eating binge. With the dysfunction of the normal homeostatic mechanisms, oppressive feelings of corporeal discomfort develop. You have an upset tummy. We expect that this triggers the release of a hormone from the gastrointestinal tract, which we provisionally call glutarin. Glutarin rapidly inactivates the effects of the Christmas hormones by negative feedback at the level of the hypothalamus, resulting in an abrupt degradation of Christmas craving. You no longer feel the need to eat Christmas cookies.
Oh.
There's also disappointment over unfulfilled expectations or inappropriate gifts, socks, or ties, results in reciprocal, conspecific, or familial aggression. You get pissed off at your family for giving you crappy gifts. These conflicts are exacerbated by inappropriate territorial behavior resulting from dislocated relatives and former friends. You have people in your bathroom. Fortunately, this phase is rapidly replaced by an extended torpor associated with emotional desensitization and sensory withdrawal. You don't care anymore. Ultimately, the experience is sufficiently traumatic that sensible plans are made to do everything different for next year and to negotiate a multilateral reduction in the extent to which behavior becomes misaligned. You're not going to do it again. This may be good thinking and willful intent. However, it is inevitable that once again, we will again totally surrender to the effects of our Christmas hormones. And just so the reader is left in no doubt that this is, in fact, a spoof article, the Declaration of Competing Interest states that the author declares that he has no interest in receiving woolen items next Christmas, to which I say he has never seen my aunt knit.
Who is your aunt knit and where does she live? Okay, so we'll be back after that humorous anecdote as a station ID.
My friends, tonight we unveil my most diabolical creation.
CITR 101.9 FM.
10 times more addictive than marijuana.
Ooh.
To human misery.
Nice to see you.
McPain! Ah, McBain. So glad you could make it. Have a salmon puff.
All right.
And we're back. So, as some people may or may not be aware, there is a holiday approaching called Christmas.
No.
Well, you just did a thing about hormones, so obviously, you know. So, you know, it seemed a bit cliche, but we haven't actually kind of really done a real story behind Christmas. So, let's start off with some really important questions that come up in the Christmas season. Is Christmas the birth of Jesus? Well, the short answer is no. First, the tradition of Christianity does not actually celebrate births, but celebrates deaths, or, quote, you know, the passing on to a better place. The whole tenet of Christianity is that it doesn't really matter where you were born or what you have done with your life, but that you right here and now sort of give your life over to Jesus or God or both, depending on your theology, which one works. That's why Easter is sort of the Super Bowl, Grey Cup, and World Series all wrapped up into one of the Catholic season.
Well, doesn't that really involve a birth and a death?
Easter? No, Easter is resurrection. So well, you die.
That's sort of birth.
And you're, well, it's the born again part. And actually, that is key to the whole point that your initial birth is irrelevant to the whole sort of Christian mythos. So, yeah. And of course, the second part, let's assume that Christmas is about the birth of Jesus originally.
Consider it assumed.
No one actually knows when he was born. Or, I mean, technically, we don't even know sort of if he was born. Because, I mean, he's supposed to be divine. And it's not unheard of in mythical sort of cycles for a entity to become sort of full-grown adult and just sort of appear on the scene. Now, of course, it is mentioned in two Gospels about his birth. And, of course, only the two Gospels. It's rather sort of the hidden childhood of Christ. And, of course, these two stories tell conflicting events. So they don't actually even agree in what they say themselves. And there's actually no credible third-party evidence to corroborate either one of the incidences. Although, of course, there have been numerous attempts and analysis sort of to post hoc and shoehorn in, you know, oh, this is probably the year he was born because there might have been a census and that sort of thing. But even if we go with that, the date itself is rather hit and miss. And, of course, the elephant in the room, or I guess it would be the reindeer in the room.
See, I was going to go donkey, but okay.
Okay. Is, and most of our listeners will probably know this, is December 25th, plus or minus a few days, is one of the most popular seasons for pagan celebrations, be it the winter solstice, Roman celebrations of the god of agriculture. Yeah, alcohol is right. That's a whole other thing. Saturnalius festival. And, of course, the cult of Mithra's most holy day coincidentally happens to fall on the 25th of December. One of the geniuses of the early church leaders wasn't the fact, I mean, they didn't sit there and say, well, let's destroy these other competing religions. Let's get rid of all of their holy places, all of the things. What they did is they co-opted them. They said, well, okay, you have this big festival. Great. You know, and let's say it's winter solstice. So the evil demon of darkness is finally defeated on this day by the joyousness of the light.
And you celebrate with cookies.
Right. Raw cookie dough. But, of course, what the Christians did, instead of sitting and saying, okay, we're going to ban the winter solstice festival. No, no. What they would say is they say, well, instead of saying that it was like, you know, darkness, let's say it was like Satan and evil. And that the light that destroys the evil is like our Jesus, like our God, defeating, you know, the power of darkness and bringing on the light. Forgive me.
Don is still,
you know, recovering.
Not so much on his last legs anymore, but still a little bit under the weather.
But the point being, to go back to our story, is their ability to sort of co-opt these sort of pagan festivals and recast them in sort of a veneer of Christianity, which is really where you kind of get the whole Christmas is the birth of Jesus. It's just a recasting of an old one. Thus, in the 4th century, the Christian church began to actually officially celebrate Jesus' birthday in the middle of all this sort of pagan festivals, just casting into a theological light. So thus, things like burning of candles to hold back the darkness of the day becomes recast of the eternal warmth of God's love. The Christmas tree goes from being, you know, the everlasting life of Germanic tribes to become the it becomes adorned with apples and sort of becomes the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden, and all these just things become recast. An interesting thing I didn't know, but doing my research, is that the John the Baptist, the person who converted Jesus to Christianity,
yes,
and a very poor manipulation of the work, his birthday is set at the summer solstice.
How convenient. There is sort of,
yeah, it's an interesting tat for tit, tit for tat. So that's with that. Now, of course, another big landmark about Christmas is the Christmas tree. Where did the Christmas tree come from? I know, the forest. But if a Christmas tree falls in the forest, does it have presents?
That's a nice pun. But the song O Tannenbaum leads me to believe it's of German origin.
Largely, yes. Most research places the Christmas tree to Northern Europe. During the dark days of winter, the Celtic people, Germanic people, you can cast them however you wish, celebrated the winter solstice as sort of the time when summer was on its way back, right?
I still celebrate that, man. Like, meh, the mornings are going to start happening a little bit earlier next week, and the afternoons a little bit late. I'm stoked.
Yay, winter solstice.
Spring in the tree.
Yeah. So in order to sort of remind people about the good times ahead, they would go out and they would cut down an evergreen and place it as a centerpiece sort of their activities. The evergreen, of course, being the only sort of green tree left in the middle of winter, was sort of the sign of unending life and striving through the dark days of winter.
Well, I hope that they remembered to have a tree stand full of water, or else A, tree's going to fall over, and B, that tree is not going to be green for that long.
Well, true, true. But ironically enough, there is points to that as well. So another thing that was actually quite popular are wreaths of pines, you know, pine wreaths that you get up there, right? Which, of course, are often hung up on doors and windows and all that to sort of keep off the evil spirits of winter. Because, again, we're talking about the middle of winter. Foodstuffs are beginning to come quite short.
Mm-hmm.
People are beginning to die from cold. They're beginning to die from starvation. And this whole idea of any life force that can hold off this evilness. And, of course, the Christians at first tried hard to get rid of this aspect. Because to them, worshipping a tree was just pure paganism and not a very good thing. But at some point, again, the Christian fathers sort of said, hey, we ain't going to win this one. This is just too deep-rooted. So we'll just recast it.
Deep-rooted.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm here all week. So they essentially attempted to recast it in a more Christian theme. Now, of course, this still remained a relatively Germanic sort of thing, right? It never really caught on big in the rest of the Christian world until, of course, Queen Victoria, who, as we all know, was a very good German.
Trendsetter.
Yeah, and her husband, of course, Prince Albert. They celebrated Christmas with a Christmas tree. It was part of their sort of culture heritage. And in 1841, there was an illustration of the Queen with her Christmas tree. And, of course, everyone wanted to be like the Queen at that time. Monarchy, very, very popular in England at the time. And that's where, boom, you just had this tremendous growth in the whole Christmas tree as a part of the Christmas tradition. Before then, it was not really that common outside of, again, the Nordic sort of...
Which, before safe lighted lights, was a pretty good idea because they had real flames on the trees, which is kind of dangerous.
Well, actually, you see, that was another thing, though. You had mentioned about how it dries out and that sort of thing, right?
True that.
Right. Well, but part of that was also built into the whole celebration. Because one, you would burn the logs, the Christmas tree essentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that would provide you warmth, it would provide you light, and you'd have this nice pine scent. And you may or may not know, because you growing up in a very hygienic family, I grew up in a very hygienic family, but I have read places that if you get a lot of people cramped up in a single house, a longhouse type thing, with very poor hygienic conditions, not much ventilation, no one allowed to leave because it's too cold outside, a certain odor will start to permeate the building. So the burning of pine would help remove that sort of scent.
It's like incense.
Exactly.
Or,
exactly.
You know, a little Glade flameless candle with extra flame.
Yeah, I was going to say with extra heavy-duty flame. But again, so, I mean, there was a lot of things. But again, co-opted, and it's become part of our tradition. And really not much of the Christian tradition, even by today's fundamentalist standards. It's just sort of decorations.
Yeah.
Which is why it's funny when a lot of the fundamentalists complain about, well, they put up a Christmas tree in Central Park, or they won't put up one because it's considered to be a Christian symbol, when it's not really.
Mm.
But, of course, most of the fundamentalists get upset about nativity scenes and them being denied. So then I thought, hey, where did the nativity scene come from?
And, Bethlehem. Everybody knows that.
You would think. You would think. Seen by many, like say fundamentalist Christians, as probably the most iconic Christmas image, the nativity scene is Jesus in a manger surrounded by Mary and Joseph and some animals and the wise men. We've all kind of seen it at one point or another.
You betcha.
Those of us less fortunate may have had to reenact it in school at some point or another.
You had to play the baby Jesus, didn't you?
Yeah, no. But I grew up in a time when the church and state wasn't quite so separate as it is now. But apparently the origin of the nativity scene, or more historically, the nativity crib, traces back to the 13th century when St. Francis of Assisi, in an attempt to make his last Christmas on earth one to remember, created the manger scene sans Jesus. So there was no Jesus in the original. He just sort of created where everything happened.
So everyone was just staring at an empty major?
Essentially. But, of course, now this is apocryphal. As Francis began to chant the Holy Gospel, quote-unquote, the Babe of Bethlehem appeared. Francis hugged the child, and of course, poof, the child disappeared, and everyone felt quite holy. This visit of the baby Jesus, of course, made made quite popular this sort of idea of, you know, having the manger, and Jesus might appear to you, right? And of course, props eventually began to stand in for what essentially was a pantomime by Francis Assisi. He was sort of doing a play with the manger sort of props, and that...
My question is, why would you ever want to be visited by a baby Jesus? Like, if you're going to be visited by Jesus, who during his lifetime, as far as, you know, what's commonly attributed to him saying, he had some wise things to say, but, like, would you want to be visited by a baby Einstein? No, you'd want to be visited by Einstein.
Oh, but you have to remember the Christian ethos here. Baby Jesus was the epitome of purity. Because, I mean, we remember teenage Jesus had evil thoughts. And then the later Jesus...
Oh, teenage Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. And we remember that, you know, young adult Jesus had dalliances with hookers. Let us not forget.
Hookers are people, too.
Yes. God, I can't remember her name right now. Not my hooker, his hooker. you only hear it first. So anyhow, again, originally done sort of as a pantomime, you know, with real people and all that. Soon the living people were replaced by props. And by the 16th century, it was actually deemed heretical to perform the nativity scene because there were so many sort of mystic overtones. You know, you were kind of trying to elicit the spirit of Jesus, and that kind of struck them as more magical. However, German immigrants are credited with reviving the pantomime version when they came back to America, and that's where we kind of have our traditional vision of the pantomime. The nativity scene with all the little props and all that. Mm-hmm. So, not really a ancient tradition.
Nor one that was always endorsed.
No, exactly. You know, it's very bizarre. And speaking of not being endorsed, you know what's another popular thing at Christmas?
I know lots of popular things at Christmas. Have I mentioned cookies?
You did. And which are better, cookies you get or cookies you give?
I don't want to offend any of my baking friends.
Okay. Well, gift giving is one of the big things at Christmas time.
True.
And ironically enough, if you ignore the idea of Christmas, but this time of year, it is probably the oldest and truest part of the tradition. It has its actual roots in the Roman celebration of Saturnalia, where feasting, orgies, and gift giving were preeminent.
Sounds like Christmas to me.
Similarly, during the solstice festival, it was quite common for people to gather and exchange gifts, or perhaps more accurately, to sort of pool their resources in lean times and offer gifts to the sun. Please come back. We miss you, that sort of thing. So, again, you know, it seems quite a very long-lasting, and actually, in many ways, the real root of Christmas has nothing to do with, you know, real Christianity or anything, but this idea of giving to others as sort of a nice gesture to do, as sort of a thank you.
So are we saying that Christmas really is about Santa Claus?
Well, we'll talk about Santa later, but yes, it is sort of...
More about gift-giving and gift-centric than Jesus-centric?
Exactly. In fact, the church tolerated this tradition until the Protestant Reformation, when, most notably in England, Christmas was outlawed.
Gasp.
Well, this was sort of the first modern attempt to sort of overlook the true origins of Christmas and to sort of restore the false but reason for the season. Of course, by the time the Victorians came around, you know, 19th century, most of the religious aspect of Christmas had actually gone. I mean, in Victorian England, religion was sort of, it was there, but it was not really the reason for the season. Things like Charles Dickinson and his A Christmas Carol and "Twas the Night Before Christmas," which was an American version of a Christmas poem sort of thing, had replaced Jesus and everything and all that, and had replaced it with this idea of charity and giving to others and to be with family and to be good to your fellow man. And those have sort of become the dominant themes. So, you had mentioned this funny, jolly old fellow.
I had.
Where did Satan, I mean Santa, what's he got to do with Christmas? The origins of Santa is far from the North Pole. Most people attribute Santa to be St. Nicholas, who was a 4th century bishop, famous for his generosity, afforded to him, of course, because of inheritance, not because he was a good person, but he had good parents. And, of course, being a bishopric, you get lots of money being a bishopric. It's one of the perks of the job.
Sorry, are you saying that you don't get to get credit for having a good personality if someone gave it to you by raising you right?
Yes. I don't think that's quite what I said.
You have to be born by horrible parents and then turn out to be a good person?
No, I'm saying that if you are gifted with a lot of money at birth, it's much easier for you to be a generous soul.
Yes. No, easier, yes. You said he was generous not because he just was, but because his parents raised him right.
Did I mention he lived in Turkey?
No. Oh, my goodness. Really?
Nowhere near the North Pole. The late Bishop Nicholas became a saint largely thanks to his bones. Apparently, his earthly remains oozed an oily substance that was purported to have miraculous healing powers. He is also he's also credited in ghostly form from saving a little boy from Arab raiders in Turkey, and this all became part of his sort of mythos and why he became a saint. And of course, in another made up story, he is believed to have overheard. And again, I love the context of these things if you pull them apart. So, story goes, St. Nicholas was listening to a father talking about how he would, how he could not marry off his three daughters because he was too poor to afford a dowry to make them desirable wives, and thus forcing the father to sell the daughters into prostitution. Now, of course, I sit there and I say, well, that doesn't sound quite right, because I'm sure there were a lot of poor people who didn't sell their daughters into prostitution, just married them off to the banker, someone else. But anyhow, having overheard this conversation, St. Nicholas, waiting till night, because he wanted to be anonymous, threw in through the window of this father three bags of gold, so they have a proper dowry. And these, coincidentally, landed in socks that were drying by the fireplace of each daughter. Ergo, why we put socks up at Christmas to get Christmas gifts. In a more gruesome story, and again, part of the whole why St. Nicholas is the patron saint of prostitutes in the first case.
Mm-hmm.
He's also the patron saint of children and why we associate mostly with children. Ready for a gruesome story?
Always.
Apparently, St. Nicholas was traveling and stopped in an inn one day. In the inn, for a good piece of gold, the innkeeper offered Nick some meat. Now, of course, Nick thought this was kind of odd because it was in the middle of a famine and meat was kind of hard to come by. In fact, no one had had meat for months. So his little suspicious mind went down and he checked out the inn's basement, being a good detective. And down there he found three dead boys who were being pickled and the source of the meat that the innkeeper was serving. Being, of course, the good, kind-hearted person, Nicholas resurrected the three boys and ran away in the middle of the night with the boys. Who knows what happened to the next set of boys that happened to walk by this inn. I guess they needed their own saint. But for these reasons, again, he becomes the patron saint of children. And, of course, that's why he's associated with it.
So are these boys, like, missing pieces?
If you're miraculously healed, I'm sure the pieces just appear.
Oh, good.
He became known through these sort of things for his gift giving. But of course, originally, St. Nicholas' feast and the giving of gifts was actually December 6th. But this, of course, competed with other things, and the Christians wanted to have a reason why you should be giving gifts at Christmas to compete with the pagan holidays. So St. Nicholas got wrapped up into Christmas and why we give Christmas gifts at Christmas is because of St. Nicholas and competing with pagans. Yay! Of course, Santa is a contraction of Santa Claus, which is the Americanization of Sinterklaas, the Dutch term for St. Nicholas. Traditionally a thin fellow, it was not until an illustration of the poem, The Night Before Christmas, in 1863 by Thomas Nast, that Santa became a jolly fat man. And of course, thanks to Coca-Cola,
He got dressed in red.
Dressed in red, and he is the Santa as we know today. Unless you're into claymation, in which case there's a very famous...
See, it's pretty convenient to stick him on the North Pole, though, because kids can't go looking for him.
Unless you're Inuit.
North Pole's pretty high.
You know, they're... And, of course, is it the magnetic North Pole or the geographic North Pole?
Maybe it's big enough that it encompasses both.
Could be. So the last thing I wanted to point out, and where we'll end today's discussion on Christmas, is when did Christmas become a holiday? Can you guess? Can you guess? It's become a festival for hundreds of years, but when did it actually become sort of a holiday?
Well, when did we start to get holidays?
Well, that's the
And
thing.
I say we from a Canadian standpoint.
Well, we actually can... Ironically enough, since the Protestant Reformation... It was not a holiday of any kind because you know, Christian work ethics, right? You worked on Christmas Day and it was just like any other day. You prayed a bit more, but you prayed as much as you did Thursday.
Did you eat any duck?
No.
Oh.
Well, not today.
I'm glad we have Christmas now.
But it wasn't actually until 1870 that Christmas became an official day off of work. Well, technically it became a day off of work for bankers because that's when the official Bankers Holiday Act was passed in England and we got it through that. Americans passed a similar thing about the same time of year. Of course, labor had to wait a few decades or so before they got a day off on the same thing. But of course, by that point, the religious, as I mentioned, of Christianity had pretty much been expunged. It wasn't a Christian holiday. It was sort of a family holiday. And of course, one of the classic examples, and I love this, was the very first Christmas card, which was, I think, in 1840s. Can't remember now exactly the date, early on. But the very first Christmas card had sort of three panels. And on the left and right, you had sort of these monochrome of giving charity, you know, giving food to the poor, mm-hmm. giving clothing to the, you know, helpless. And right in the middle were a bunch of fat people in color, drinking wine and feeding up and just having a hell of a good old time with the little caption saying, a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you. So Christmas, a wonderful holiday, but very little to do with Christianity. So I say go out there and put the real reason back in the season. Get drunk.
Get presents.
Give presents. And just be nice to your fellow human being.
Oh, well, that isn't that jolly from you, Don?
Yay. So now we come to that wonderful point of the day of our skeptic highlights. Jenna.
Indeed.
Do you have any... highlights that are skeptical.
I do. So I encourage our listeners, if they are at all inclined, to check out the Canadian Cochrane Research Center, which I recently found out about. So this is an institution that compiles systematic reviews produced using a specific protocol. These reviews evaluate and integrate knowledge about healthcare practices in Canada. So this is kind of a follow-up to last week's discussion on the sort of too much data problem. And the same thing is found in the thousands of case studies published every year in the medical journals. So this initiative is funded by the Canadian Institute for Health Research and aims to pull meaning from all this madness of all this data. And so I think it's a really fabulous initiative. And if people are looking for consensus rather than a individual study, they might want to check it out.
Cool. I've got two here. Skeptics in the Pub. This week, the bar-hopping skeptics will be gathering twice. First, tonight at 7:30 at the Railway Club downtown at Dunsmuir and Seymour. There will also be another outing for Skeptic Cheer in Richmond on Thursday at 7:30 at Legends Club. That's a block east on No. 3 Road and Cook Road. Check them out for good food, good drink, and better company than a Catholic Mass. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
And this is Jenna saying, the real Christmas is amazing.
Excellent.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Pick up your winter issue of Discorder, as the Jan-Sember issue is packed with goodies that will warm even the coldest of cockles. Take a dip with Dixie's Death Pool, a spacey art rock collective, or read up on local outsider pop music makers, World Club. Cozy up on the couch with Filmstripped, featuring a review of Color Me Obsessed, a documentary on The Replacements. And in case you missed the memo, 2012 is almost here. Check out the Discorder album picks of 2011. Don't forget to pick up your special Jan-Sember issue of Discorder.
passing me precious carbon dioxide.
I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?